Willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, zum Medienturm, zum Dessert nach dem gestrigen Jubiläumsclub mit Luke Haynes. Heute ein bisschen was anderes, das er erzählt oder vorliest. Also, die erste Passage ist die gleiche wie gestern. Luke Haynes hat diverse Alben aufgenommen. Zuerst mit seiner ersten Band, The Servants. Die machten ein Album, das dann sehr, sehr selten ist heutzutage. Dann mit den Auteurs, das war in den 90er Jahren. Dann.
I'm just laughing at the amount of, that's not even half of them.
I know. I mean, he's made an incredible number of records, half of which I have here. The latest of his solo albums. Luke Haynes in Setting the Dogs on the Post-Punk Postman. He's also, that was last year, he's also written books. One is Bad Vibes, from which he will be reading a little. And the second one is not yet translated into German. It's called Post Everything Outside of Rock and Roll, which prompted a newspaper in England to say of him that he was a national treasure in waiting. He also writes a column for a magazine called Record Collection. Record Collector, well worth reading, deeply amusing, as most things that you do are.
Okay. I'll take it, yeah.
Luke, first, well, you're going to be doing some reading first. What are you going to read us?
Well, I thought I'd do a kind of a dissertation on how to... can you translate dissertation?
Dissertation, same thing.
Okay, yeah, there we go. Yeah. Just so I'm
you clear... You speak what I'm, German well.
No, just so we're clear what I'm talking about. A dissertation on sort of how not to have a hit single, and then how to have a hit single in the UK. So we'll start with, this is a point of how not to have a hit single. This chapter is called Piss Poor Attitude, TV Transgressions Part 1. And it'll be translated after I read it. So just to set the picture, this is where my old band in the 1990s, the Auteurs, were on a TV show trying to promote our latest single and failing to promote it in the proper way. "Well done, lads," squeaks the tall man with the thick, upstanding shock of red hair in a perfectly irritating Midlands accent. The highly strung bark of 1 hour ago now reduced by several levels to a tone that might be described as, "Pally, I hate you." "We'll have to get you back when we do it for real," continues the voice of stupidity, the voice on the radio, the man on TV. "I don't want to do it for real. I've just done it for real. I certainly don't want to come back because I never want to see you again. The only thing I want to do right now is for the lifeblood to drain out of you and to know that by morning you will be a cold corpse." "Can I get you a drink?" asks Chris Evans, the subject of my inner and soon to be outer rancor, still very much alive and kicking. Evans is an unpleasant creature, a shallow bullying man-child, a jumped-up kissogram turned light entertainment colossus, camp commandant of the joyless Radio 1 breakfast show, and now about to extend his métier as a kind of Britpop Joseph Goebbels to a torturous television show of his own creation, TFI Friday. Thank fuck it's Cried Friday. I know. Great. Evans and his pet monkeys are the types who think that TV and radio are, like, you know, really, really important, and talk about making great TV and great radio as if they are actually making great TV and great radio. For those who sense an opportunity to get on in life, for those who want to knuckle under, or for those who are simply masochists, then Evans is your man. In the kingdom of the blind, the four-eyed man is king, and this dick likes to wield his dick around. The Evans seal of approval is the golden ticket to that mirthless Armageddon they call success. Naturally, radio and TV pluggers will subject themselves to most forms of humiliation just for Evans' producer to tip them the wink. So it is more by bad luck than judgment that the auteurs, on a miserable day in January 1996, are appearing on The Pilot, oh yes, The Pilot, for his new TFI Friday show, in the hope of one day coming back to perform our new single, Light Aircraft on Fire. Drink, repeats Chris Evans.
Die Übersetzung liest wie immer und wie immer wunderbar, da bin ich absolut überzeugt. Der Ernst Gossner.
Kapitel 24, armselige Einstellung, Fernsehvergehen, erster Teil. Nicht schlecht, Jungs, näselte der große Mann mit dem dichten, hochstehenden, roten Haarschopf mit seinem totalen, nervigen Mitleidsakzent. Das gereizte Bellen von vor einer Stunde hat er zurückgeschraubt auf ein Level, das man als kumpelhaft bezeichnen könnte. Ich hasse. Wenn wir dann ernst machen, holen wir euch natürlich wieder in die Sendung, fuhr die Stimme fort. Die Stimme der Dummheit, die Stimme aus dem Radio, die Stimme aus dem Fernsehen. Ich will nicht ernst machen. Ich habe vorher schon ernst gemacht und zurückkommen will ich auch nicht, schon weil ich dich nie wiedersehen will. Das Einzige, was ich will, ist, dass dir das Blut aus dem Körper sickert, damit du morgen früh nur noch eine kalte Leiche bist. Soll ich Ihnen einen Trick holen? Fragt Chris Evans. Das Objekt meines innerlichen, bald jedoch auch äußerlich deutlich sichtbaren Hasses, der immer noch gesund und munter vor mir steht. Evans ist eine unangenehme Erscheinung, ein oberflächlicher, rüppelhafter Berufsjugendlicher und hochnäsiger, vom Kissogrammboden zur leichten Unterhaltung aufgestiegener Wichtigtour. Er ist Lagerkommandant der freudlosen Radio 1 Frühstücksshow, der jetzt dabei ist, seinen Bereich auszuweiten und sich mittels einer von ihm selbst entwickelten Vorabend-TV-Show zu einer Art Josef Goebbels des Britpop zu entwickeln. TF1 Friday, thank fuck it's Friday, schon klar. Evans und seine handzahmen Äffchen gehören zu den Typen, die glauben, dass Fernsehen und Radio irgendwie ganz, ganz wichtig sind, und sie sprechen über gutes Fernsehen und gutes Radio, als ob sie tatsächlich gutes Fernsehen und gutes Radio machen würden. Für alle, die eine Möglichkeit suchen, es im Leben zu etwas zu bringen, für alle, die sich bedingungslos unterordnen wollen und auch für die, die einfach mal zu Christen sind, ist Evans genau der richtige Mann. Unter den Blinden ist der vieräugige König, und dieser Wichser führt ein hartes Regiment. Wenn Evans etwas abgenickt hat, ist das praktisch eine goldene Eintrittskarte in das freudlose Armageddon, das man Erfolg nennt. Natürlich lassen die Rundfunkpromoter der Plattenfirmen fast jede Form der Erniedrigung über sich ergehen, wenn sie dafür von Evans Produzenten rechtzeitig vorgewarnt werden. Und das war wohl nur ein dummer Zufall und keine Fehleinschätzung, dass die Auteurs an einem elenden Tag im Januar 1996 in der Pilotsendung ausgerechnet dieser neuen TF1 Friday Show auftraten, in der Hoffnung, eines Tages wiederkommen zu dürfen, um unsere neue Single Light Aircraft on Fire in der Show zu spielen. Einen Trick, wiederholt Chris Evans.
Chris Evans was kind of the pinnacle of lat culture, as they called it. Boys who liked to behave badly, who should know better. I think the strap line was of Loaded magazine.
Yeah.
Was that possibly the most embarrassing youth movement that the Brits ever invented?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it was, well, it was real. I was going to say it was, but it's quite an easy jump to make, because I think what happened, my theory on why that whole period that was called Cool Britannia came around, was because a lot of men who were in their mid-20s at that point had felt kind of grown up and felt emasculated by Margaret Thatcher, who was our Prime Minister for a long time. And I think it was a reaction against that. That's how all of that thing came about, all that kind of Britpop thing. It was all a reaction against Thatcher. That's my theory, anyway.
It's an interesting theory. Does that mean we can sort of maybe almost hope that in 2 years' time we have a reaction to Liz Truss?
Well, times are different, aren't they? Because we now have, you know, we have sort of social media and things like that that kind of replace, I suppose, movements, if you like. So people kind of vent their displeasure or whatever you want to say via that rather than via pop music or via magazines anymore. Because a magazine couldn't be a big thing now because no one really buys them. So you couldn't have a magazine really influencing culture.
Well, then you have bands like Three-Foot Mods, who I'm not a great fan of, who very efficiently and with massive audience sort of express a lot of the dissatisfaction that a lot of people have. Without putting it in exact words.
Well, I mean, I disagree with you because I love Three-Foot Mods. I think they're fantastic. I think they're actually the best British band, if you want to call them that, for years and years. I also like to claim that I discovered them, which is not quite true. But I did.
Just lied to us.
A friend of mine, an artist friend of mine, we were the people that kind of, we sort of bigged them up for ages and ages before they got any radio play. We used to go to their gigs when they were playing in pubs and they were playing to like five people. And it was just like this really, I don't know if you know this group, this really angry guy shouted into a mic with his friend who would just bob around with a can of lager in the corner. It was just like, it looked incredibly violent and really good. And so it surprised me how big they became because I thought there was no chance. It shows what I would be a terrible A&R man. Because although I loved them, I would never have signed them. I'd only signed them because I thought they were a brilliant band. But to be the kind of level they're at is astonishing. And maybe that is a sign of the disaffection in the UK.
Well, the funny thing is every pub has a Three-Foot Mod in the corner.
Exactly. It? Yeah. Well, there's a Three-Foot Mod in every couple of roads in Britain. Yes. Yeah.
Well, and let's hope there are going to be more. Would you like to play a song?
Yeah, I'll play a song. This is, as I was reading a bit about my old band, this is a single that my old band put out. This one was almost a hit. And then I'll read something about actually how you do have a hit. I don't think you really can know how to, but I'm going to try and make out I can. Anyway, this is an old single.
On the street of every shape and size, the motor kicking down from the thondo. Assassins on the corner tried to throw you a line. Your dirty mouth coming, Rodolfo. A Mazzolini, Valentino Rezai. Valentino Rezai. Valentino Rezai. The Pope renounced you as the real one. Lazarus decided to rise. The 20th century had only begun. Ladies averted their eyes. And that's a lady, Valentino resigned. Valentino resigned. Valentino resigned. Reading the law, kitty in the hall with your mother. The girls are sick and tired of your blah blah blah. Some big kid said there's no other, and that's a Lenny, Valentino reside. Valentino reside. Valentino reside.
Shall I read? So this book, Post Everything, unfortunately has not been translated, but basically it's kind of like part two of the story that started with bad vibes.
Yeah. Okay, so this chapter, this is about how you do have a hit single. So this is about my second or third band, Black Box Recorder, who we did manage to kind of have a top 10 single in April 2000, a long time ago. only seems like a few years ago. This chapter, I should say, is called Pop Music is Wasted on the Young. Now, that is actually... that was actually a team of a great British band, old band that you might not have heard of, called Earl Brutus. And they were all kind of in their 30s. And they had a great T-shirt and they had a great kind of signs on stage which said pop music is wasted on the young. So I nicked it from them. But if you do get a chance to listen or look at any Earl Brutus stuff on YouTube, I would thoroughly recommend it. Here we go. Pop music is wasted on the young. How the hell did I get here? Well, we rather embarrassingly hired a white stretch provincial hen night limousine to pick us up, Black Box Recorder plus entourage, from our favourite pub, the Spread Eagle in Camden Town, where the landlady and the landlord wave us off. We're very good customers. Then it's straight up the Finchley Road onto the North Circular to Elstree Studios. No, how the hell did I get here, the main street? The last time I was anywhere near a TV show, I got involved in an argument with the producer about disabled rights, a subject I had no interest in before or since or at the time. And the occasion before that, well, never mind. That was the last bit I actually read out. Let's just say I'm as surprised as anybody else to be here on a wet Tuesday morning in April at the BBC studios, miming the latest Black Box Recorder single on Top of the Pops. Or am I? Let me tell you a tale of brave and noble men and damsels in distress and Top of the Pops. The Facts of Life, our new single, has settled in at number 7 in the UK singles chart. Proof enough if it were needed, and it is, because this one is a pop record, and that is the point of pop records, to be popular, that we have succeeded in doing what we set out to do. Give the world a scientifically constructed hit record. We might as well enjoy it while it lasts, brackets, which won't be for long, end of brackets, because for you, Black Box Recorder, the war is over. Let's just say, for the sake of context and to make life easy, that the first Black Box Recorder album, England Made Me, was a commercial disaster. I thought it sold pretty well, but the record company disagreed. The upshot of this is some unenlightened yet predictable behaviour from our then label Chrysalis, who drop us a few months after the album's release in mid-1998. For me, this is a mere trifling setback. I'm still signed to Hut Records as the auteurs, and I'm still quite bafflingly being showered with more money than I know what to do with. For Sarah, our frontwoman, singer, cipher, persona, the consequences of Chrysalis's lack of foresight are more significant. She has had to whisper it, go back into the workplace. As for John Moore, my co-writer, the workplace is not an option. Whenever money gets tight, he seems to have an elaborate yet entirely legal system of compensation schemes to fall back on. Yes, Sarah is the one who is suffering in this strange and frightening world of the workplace. It's a tragedy, and John and I feel more than a twinge of guilt. After all, we are the ones who dragged damsel Nixie out of the world of gainful employment, and now, at the tender age of 25, she's been cruelly thrown back there. We must act. We're chivalrous knights of the realm, on a mission to save our sweet maiden. We will lay down our metaphorical coat across the putrid puddle of degradation that is the workplace. Place your dainty foot forwards, dear lady. Step over into our magical land. Sweet chanteuse, if we cannot write a hit single for ourselves, then for all the right reasons, we shall write you a proper fuck-off hit single.
There you go. How did fame change your life?
Not much. when we were on Top of the Pops, you're allowed to bring an entourage with you. So we brought all our friends with us. And the studio is quite small. I don't know if you're aware of Top of the Pops, but it was a very famous British TV programme. So if you went on Top of the Pops, you were kind of a pop star. That's how it worked. And it was watched by millions and millions of people. But we brought our entourage, our friends, with us. And as soon as we started to kind of do the dress rehearsal, the run-through, the producers asked our friends if they could stand at the back and they could have some young people. So that's sort of... that's sort of the... that doesn't quite answer your question, but that's the sort of reality of Top of the Pops. And it was... I remember the audience being very, very... very they bus in the audience of young people. That they pick them up from clubs and stuff, they used to. And the audience were very nonplussed by us. And I was sort of... I didn't really care. I thought, this is fine. It's what it is. And then... Britney Spears was on after us, and so there's another stage. But weirdly, the audience was still kind of nonplussed with her, and it was just a very, very. It was just like these sort of kids who kind of they could just about kind of on cue. I'd go 1, 2, 3, you're on, yeah, and then immediately they'd just be back to kind of. And it was the same for Britney Spears. I thought they'd kind of be frothing. But they weren't, and I think Eminem was also on that week, and it was the same thing. It's just really weird. Like, what do you have to do to impress these kids? I don't know.
When you watch all Top of the Pops or any other sort of live TV music thing from the 60s, the baffling thing is that the whole audience doesn't actually watch the band. They look into the camera
and
do that kind
exactly,
of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you speak to any of the other stars that were on with you?
No, because you just get... You kind of get wheeled in to do your thing, and because it's the BBC, they're more concerned with like, if you've got any kind of, because the BBC aren't allowed to advertise, so they check all your gear, your amplifiers, to make sure that they haven't got anything on them that could be seen as advertising. So if you've got, then they put tape over the make of your amplifier, that kind of thing. The weird thing was I had a guitar, my Fender guitar, but it had a sticker on it of Princess Diana in a minefield. And the producer came over and looked at it, and he's kind of like, that's okay. So I don't like it when people use the word surreal to describe things, but it was quite surreal, yeah.
Well, the hit record followed on to a record that was a band, a one-off thing, called Baader-Meinhof.
Yeah, that was actually before. Yeah.
What possessed you to think that might be a hit record?
Oh, I didn't think it would be a hit record, but I enjoyed making it, and I was interested in reading about European terrorism. This is a long time before terrorism sort of became fashionable again. It's black humour. I don't mean that. I don't condone these things at all. And so I had these lyrics that I really liked that I thought were kind of interesting, and I wanted to kind of do a different kind of music. So I kind of branched out into this sort of, I suppose it was kind of broken kind of funk, which is very different from what I've been doing before. It was just an experiment. I thought it was pretty good. And it's, you know, it seems to be kind of well-liked, that record. It was banned in Germany, I should add. And there was what's the main publication, the big news?
Spiegel.
I know that there was an issue of, there was an interview with me in Spiegel, and I know that the whole issue was pulped. Because it wasn't the subject that was meant you were really allowed to talk about. Still,
blimey,
this was in 1996, I think, and obviously the Baader-Meinhof group hadn't been active for nearly 20 years.
I mean, 1996, so we're in the middle of Britpop. I mean, even a title like that is a bit like a petard in the.
Well, I was never. I always maintained, and still, that I was never part of Britpop.
No.
Anyway, so that was just another way. It wasn't a deliberate kind of going against things or trying. It wasn't being contrary. It was just where my head was. That's just what I wanted to do, so I did it. And luckily enough, the record company, I don't know how, I don't know why they let me do it, but they did. That was kind of like, okay. You know, and I thought, well, if you're going to let me do this, and if you're going to give me the money to record it, then I'm going to do it a damn good job of it.
Does that sort of indicate that, like, record companies in the 1990s still, that gave artists a lot of freedom?
No.
Or were you in a particularly privileged position?
I think I was in a very lucky position. That the guy, David Boyd, who I don't think is in the music business anymore, but I still hear from him time to time, was a very good A&R guy, and he allowed me to do what I like, do what I wanted to, and I was signed to a major label for over 10 years, which is a long time, and you know, some of the records sold, a lot of them didn't, so you know, God bless him really for that, and he did, you know, he did say to me at one point, I didn't sign you to have hit records. And I said, what did you sign me for? It's a really weird thing for a record label to say. But he kind of hid me from the accountants for quite a few years. And I was always very glad. I was, when certain groups like The Verve, who are on the same label as me, they went massive after about their third album. And that was great because I knew that the money was there and I could do more stuff. So their success was sort of my success as well. And I knew that there was so much money at that record label because Hut Records bought a Formula One car. Yes. Yeah.
Was your picture on the side?
Sadly, not with my picture. No, but I knew that you know, if they could afford a Formula One car, I was pretty safe.
Well. You have a label again, a different one. You can do what you want, Jerry Red.
Yeah. They don't have quite as much money as Hut Records. I don't think they have a Formula One car, but they do have a stand at a football stadium.
Do they? Yes. Which one?
Wimbledon FC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're all very big into football.
I remember going to a game at Wimbledon, and journalists usually get fed at half time in the press enclosure. And at Wimbledon FC in the fourth division at the time, the director of the club went round with a box of biscuits to the three journalists there and brought them a cup of tea.
That's the Cherry Red way.
Would you like to play? We've nearly run out of time.
I'll tell you what, I'll just do what I ended with last night, and I'll do it again because it's always good fun. It's a bit more of an up-to-date song, so I'll just do Lou Reed, Lou Reed, which has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about, but it's just a kind of good three-chord song. If anyone's learning to play guitar, it's a good one to learn guitar to. All you need is A minor, G, and E. There you go. It goes like this. Lou Reed, Lou Reed. Lou Reed, Lou Reed. It's only got two words as well. Lou Reed, Lou Reed. 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 One more time in case you haven't got it. Lou Reed, Lou Reed. 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 Lou Reed, Lou Reed.
Thank you. This wonderful little ditty can be found on Luke's album New York in the 70s. I can only recommend it. Luke, Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Ernst, thank you very much. Thank you very much for all of you for coming. Natürlich die übliche Geschichte mit den Spenden, die Sprachsalz wahnsinnig dankbar ist für. Sie können auch gern ein Fördermitglied werden. 20 Euro das Jahr bringt dieses herrliche Privileg. Noch die nächsten zwei Lesungen um 4. Und dafür sind wir auch extrem dankbar, wenn Sie das tun. Die nächste Lesung um 4. nach 4 ist der Andreas Niedermann hier. Um 16 Uhr die Paulina Stulin im kleinen Kurhaussaal. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.
Excellent. Yeah. Good stuff.